T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track 4 games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Kindrichuk blocks it, and it comes to the near side. Kindrichuk back to Clement, a breakaway. He scores! Bill Clement for a case of Tasty Cake, and it's 2-0 Flyers. Clement mobbed by his whole bench as the Flyers come out on that.
Welcome back. Ray Dinger, Glenn Mack. Now on Saturday at noon, it is time for Tell Us Your Story, sponsored by Meridian Bank, one of the area's best business banks. Learn why at meridianbanker.com/WIP. Well, Bill Clement is a Philadelphia hockey institution. He played 4 years for the Flyers during their glory days, scoring the put-it-away goal in their Stanley Cup repeat clincher in 1975. After 11 NHL seasons, Bill went on to a tremendously successful career as a broadcaster, many of those years as a color man and analyst for Flyers games. He joins us now from his home in North Carolina. Bill, thanks for being our guest today.
Pleasure to be on board.
We always like to start with our guest's childhood. You grew up in, if I have this right, Thurzo, Quebec, a French-speaking city. In fact, you grew up 2 blocks from Guy Lafleur, who we learned recently passed away, and played hockey with him as a kid. What was that like?
Well, I was as in awe of Guy Lafleur playing with him and watching him as a kid before I got to play with him, as you know, millions of hockey fans were for so many years. He was just an incredible, before there was a Gretzky and before there was a Mario Lemieux and before there was social media, before there was internet, Guy was a household name in the province of Quebec because he had come within a hair of winning the Quebec Pee Wee Tournament, which is the biggest amateur hockey tournament in the world. And, you know, this ragtag bunch of kids from Thurso just about beat, and they were a Class C, I believe, based on population. Thurso had 3,000 people. Thurso played in the championship game against one of the big teams from Toronto and almost beat them. So everybody knew who Guy was, and I certainly did. It's funny, I'm kind of an anomaly because I grew up English in the province of Quebec. I went to a little English school. I also grew up Protestant, and our town was almost completely French Catholic. So the English kids weren't invited to play on the town team until a very progressive brother of the Catholic order came to run the Catholic school in my hometown and invited the English kids and the Protestant kids to try out for the town team. And I immediately made it and ended up playing 3 seasons with Guy. And he played up a year. He's actually his soul rest in peace. He was 9 months younger than I was. And he played up a year, and we were able to play 3 years together. And we left home the same year. He was 14 and I was 15. We both made junior teams in the Quebec League and went on to our pro careers.
Bill, it was obvious that you had a lot of talent. That was pretty obvious from the beginning. But when did it begin to dawn on you that this might not just be a game that you were playing as a kid, that hockey might be your future? How, at what age were you that you began to be scouted and you began to think that maybe you could take this further?
Well, I was scouted when I was 15 by the Chicago Blackhawks, and that's why I left home and went to a team in the Quebec League. There were 21-year-olds on our team, and I was 15. There were 74 guys at camp in the town called Sorel, to try to make the Sorel Blackhawks, which was one of the junior farm teams of the Chicago Blackhawks at the time. And there were 4 openings. And I was big by standards then, and I could really skate. And they ended up making the team. Did it dawn on me that the NHL was ahead? somewhere on the road? No, not at that age. I think it was probably when I was 18, and by that time was playing for the Ottawa 67s. I was an original of Ottawa 67 in 1967. Mm-hmm. We were an expansion team. By the time I was 18, our coach was actually telling me, look, if you take care of yourself and keep working as hard as you work, there's a pretty good chance you're going to end up in the NHL, and you might even end up being a first-round pick, which never happened. I was drafted early in the second round. But that's probably when it dawned on me that it could be a reality. But it's really interesting that you asked that question because, I don't know, about 35 years ago, I mean, I turned 71 last December, but I went to a little school reunion. There were only three rooms in the school where I went until the year I went to school, and it expanded to five big rooms and a gymnasium. But at the school reunion, and I had no recollection of this, the kids that I went to school with said, you know, you always said you were going to play in the NHL. And I had no recollection of making that statement, but it reminded me years later when I understood the importance in any endeavor of starting with the end in mind. It reminded me that so many things are possible if you start with the end in mind. So I guess I had my sights set on the target when I was a kid, but it only became a reality or started to become real when I was about 18.
Bill Clement is our guest on Tell Us Your Story. You mentioned those Ottawa 67s when they started. The first team went 6 wins, 45 losses, and 3 ties. Had to be tough.
Fortunately, that year, I broke my arm and missed most of those games.
That's it. They would have won those games. And you played with some terrific players. You played with Danny Potvin and Blake Dunlap and Bunny LaRocque down there. You were not, I did not see you play in those days, obviously. You were not a prolific scorer your third and final season. You had 19 goals in 54 games. And you weren't a first-round pick, but you were a second-round pick, as you said, 18th overall, which is, you know, these days would be middle of the first round. What was the skill set you had that was attractive to the NHL at that point?
Skating ability, work ethic, defensive ability. The one thing that was lacking was offensive ability, and that's why I spent a year in the minors, and the Flyers, our coach was named Eddie Bush, and the Flyers and Keith Allen gave him strict instructions not to let me kill any penalties, which was like depriving me of what I needed to breathe and eat, and they said just let him play power play all the time. But the reason I wasn't as gifted offensively was I didn't start playing organized hockey till I was 12. I told you about not being invited to play real organized hockey when I made it when I was 12. I guess I was shy and insecure and always felt there was somebody else on the team that could, you know, put the puck behind a goalie better than I could. So I dished all the time, and to the point where, you know, it became problematic. You got to shoot. But I always felt there was somebody else that could that put the puck away better than I could. So I dug pucks out. I opened ice up for other players and then passed off. And it's funny, one of the, you know, when people say, you know, what are your greatest memories of your career? Well, winning 2 Stanley Cups, obviously, is number one. But they said, what do you consider your great individual achievements? And I never scored 20 goals at any level of my life until I made it to the NHL. And I had 3 20-goal seasons, which doesn't make me a Hall of Famer, but it allows me to answer the question when I've been asked over the years, are scorers made or are they developed? And I said, well, look, the big guy upstairs is the only guy that can make you a 60-goal scorer. But I'm living, walking proof that if you work at it hard enough and stick with it long enough and are afforded the opportunity, that everybody can improve. I got a real late start playing. Didn't think I was good enough to shoot the puck and score. And as a result, those last couple of years junior, there were no 20s anywhere. It was 18 mm-hmm. goals and then 19 goals.
But as you said, you became known as a very good defensive player. You could really skate. You understood the principles of defense. Right. And you came along in junior era where there were a lot of really dynamic centermen who later on became stars in the NHL. One of them was Gilles Perreault, who you had a shadow when you were a junior. And also a guy that became your teammate in Philadelphia, and that was Rick McLeish.
Yeah, every team had a dynamic center. Most of the teams did. And as an expansion team coming into Ottawa, our coach knew that one of the things we had to do was to shut down our opponent's top center. So he would just tell me, follow him around and don't let him touch the puck. So that was another reason that I didn't score that many goals or develop many offensive skills. And it got to the point where a guy like Gilbert Perreault would have me trailing him to his bench. I'd spin off to go back to our bench, and he would just do a little button hook at the door. he would fake going off, right, so he could keep playing. But, I mean, I shadowed Marcel Dion, Daryl Sittler, Rick McLeish, Dale Tallon, of course, Gilbert Perreault. There was every team had one. If we played a team that didn't have a dominant center, I was kind of turned loose, so to speak. At least I didn't have that limiting assignment of never caring about touching the puck. Coach Bill Long would say, I don't care if you ever touch the puck, just don't let him touch it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that didn't really lend itself to developing that offensive skill that I lacked.
So you get drafted by the Flyers. As you say, you start out in the AHL, and then you come up. December 1971, your second game in the NHL against the Canadiens, you get an assist a minute 42 into the game, rare goal by Ed Van Impe, by the way, and then you score your first NHL goal later in that period. One period, a goal and an assist. Do you remember the play? Do you remember your first goal?
Oh, hell yeah. I actually, and you know, for a guy that didn't shoot very much, I was one-on-one against Jacques Laperriere, a defenseman for Montreal. Ken Dryden was in goal. And I got to the blue line, and Laperriere gave me the blue line. He backed in over the blue line just enough for me to take a mighty wind-up and blast a shot. And it just blew by Ken Dryden. And I can tell you, fans in Philadelphia waited for 4 years for me to do that again, and it never happened. I don't think I've ever shot a puck harder than that. But I do remember it. I ended up getting a goal and an assist my fourth game in, too, against Buffalo, and was there to stay. What's really interesting, too, about my rise from the minors to the NHL, I feel very fortunate that I didn't have to go up and down and up and down. That's so hard emotionally. You know, on a young player, I was called up. When I was called up, I never played another game in the minors. Mm-hmm. But I found out years later from the Flyers' director of player personnel, Marcel Pelletier, that I was kept in the minors longer than I should have been. Our coach was a guy named Eddie Bush that coached against me in junior. He coached in Hamilton, and then he came and coached in Quebec. And then the next year, I spent a couple of months in Richmond in the American League. And I found out, too, from our junior coach in Ottawa that Eddie Bush had always tried to trade for me. He loved my work ethic. He loved, you know, how just I was kind of a workaholic. That's how I played. And he wanted to trade for me. Well, all of a sudden, he's coaching pro, and he has me on his roster. And Marcel Pelletier told me that every week they would call down and talk. There wasn't instant video available. And they would ask Eddie how I was doing. And he would say, oh, he's struggling. He's not doing very well. And I thought I was playing pretty damn well. So Marcel Pelletier and Keith Allen came down on December the, what did you say, Ray? The date that I played my first NHL game was December the 19th, I think. Or 18th,
right, I just said December like 1971, that. Right.
Right, right. Well, Marcel and Keith Allen came down and watched one game, and I was called up. They told me right after the game, get on a plane tomorrow, you're going to play for us in Detroit. So I played in Richmond in the American League on a Friday night, in Detroit for the Flyers on a Saturday night. And that game against Montreal on the Spectrum was the third game in three nights with travel. So I was kind of running on adrenaline. Maybe that's why I took that one shot so hard. But I probably would have been in the NHL a couple of months sooner had Eddie Bush not really liked having me on his roster. Crazy.
Did you, when you, and you were aware of the organization, you were aware who was playing on the big club, but when you looked around, and you were a natural center, you always were from the time you started playing, when you looked at the team that you were going to be joining, and you saw how strong they were down the middle, when they have Bobby Clark, they have Rick McLeish, they have Orris Kinderchuk, who's a very useful little player that they loved. And then later on, they trade for Terry Crisp. I mean, you're looking around. Does it cross your mind that, you know, where's my role here? How do I fit in?
Yeah, absolutely. But it it dawned on me that, I mean, the first thing I did when I was drafted by the Flyers, I was at the draft in Montreal at the Queen Elizabeth Hotel. It wasn't a big deal that it is today, and I was drafted by the Flyers. My first thought was, who the hell do they have down the middle, right? So I wanted to kind of evaluate my chances of making the team. But I actually was a member of the organization before Rick McLeish and before Orris Kinderchuk. And when I looked at the roster, the centers were Jimmy Johnson, Gary Peters, Serge Bernier. Of course, Clarkie was, you know, leading the pack, even as a 20-year-old, 21-year-old. So things changed pretty quickly with the roster. And we acquired Orris. I was clicking along, I thought, pretty well with my position. But then Orris Kinderchuk came along, and while I could skate circles around him, he protected the puck, played with his head up, distributed the puck, and he was a kind of a natural center to play between Don Selesky and Dave Schultz. And then Ricky, when Rick McLeish kind of exploded in the NHL, I'm not sure who was going to take his job. I mean, he was a 50-goal scorer the one year. He fit in perfectly with Ross Lonsberry and Gary Dornhofer, who I had centered for a little while at the start, but they had more puck skills than I did. And it kind of became a revolving door of about five or six of us for the last three spots at the forward position, myself, Hound Kelly, Terry Crisp. And that's the way it was. It was kind of just a rotation. Freddie worked a lot of us in and out of the lineup. There's no question we had a deep roster, but I've always felt that the difference between our roster and, say, the Boston Bruins when we won our first Stanley Cup was our lower-level guys, so the guys that were not top six forwards, were not, you know, the top players on the roster, I always believe we were made to feel by Freddie and by the leaders on our team, Eddie Van Emp and Joe Watson and Bobby Clark, we were made to feel that our roles were important. And that's when I learned that if you feel important, you'll play important. And I'm not sure that the lower guys on the roster for the Bruins felt that way. It was all Esposito, you know, the huge names, everything revolved around them. Our roster was full of star-like players like Bobby Clark that shared, right, that shared and praised and demanded. I mean, Clarkie was able to have the tough conversation, even as a guy in his young 20s. I'm talking the one-on-one conversations with individual players, which most leaders and people can't have when they're that young. So we were sort of in a rotation in and out of the lineup, a number of us, and it seemed to work.
Bill, you mentioned a lot of names there. Bill Clement is our guest for Tell Us Your Story. And from when you came up, you know, in December 71 through up to and including when the team won those cups, it transitioned. It became the Broad Street Bullies and Schultz and Kelly and Selesky and DuPont, the whole crew. You are not a shrinking violet, but the most penalty minutes you ever had in a season is 51. You were, if you get this reference, kind of the Michael Ontkean is Nick Braden in Slapshot. What was that like for you to be a guy on a team where, hey, there were great stars on that team, you know, Bernie and Clark and Barber and so on, but that was kind of the brand of the team.
Yeah. Well, whether you wanted to be or not, you were in the middle of it, right? I mean,
yeah, sure.
When it hit the fan, everybody was in on it. And I recognized it as one of the important components of how we won games, and that was with intimidation. I mean, I didn't fight. I probably had one fight a year just to announce that I would if I had to. Mm-hmm. Terry Crisp didn't fight very much at all, if at all. So, you know, Joe Watson never fought. Jimmy never fought. Eddie used his stick, and it was intimidating. So we had a bunch of guys that didn't fight very much, but we also had a nucleus of players, including the baddest animal in the hockey jungle, Dave Schultz. We had enough guys to do the heavy lifting that the rest of us didn't really have to. We had to stand up for ourselves, and very often our teammates would stand up for us. But there's no question that one of the ingredients to us being champions was our ability to intimidate. But that said, our win against the Boston Bruins was significant because they weren't a team that was that we could intimidate. I mean, they were tougher than nails, mm-hmm. all of them. You know, Bobby Orr was a tough player. You know, Phil just kept playing. Phil Esposito, Terry O'Reilly was an animal the way he played. So I don't think anybody could say that we won the series against the Boston Bruins because we intimidated them. I can say that I believe we did the next year against the Buffalo Sabres. They had their tough guys were pseudo-tough guys. Our tough guys were really tough guys. So I recognize the toughness of our team as one of the key ingredients to winning. So I certainly didn't mind being part of it. The greatest line that I've ever heard about what it was like to come into the Spectrum and play, and I knew that. I played almost seven seasons after I left the Flyers organization. Yep. So coming to play in the Spectrum was intimidating, even for me, coming back. But the best line about what it was like being a visiting player coming into the Spectrum was my great friend Brian Engblom, who won Stanley Cups in Montreal, and I worked with him on TV for a number of years. He said, it was really interesting, he said, when the bus would pull into the Spectrum, down underneath the Spectrum, and that great big garage door would close behind the bus, when he played for the Montreal Canadiens, the bus driver would turn off the bus, and it would still be shaking.
Wow.
So that's what it was like for other teams to come in and play against
them. Yeah. Let's take a quick break, and then let's go through those cups. Let's go through your career, and let's get to the broadcasting part of your career, which, boy, a lot of decades, a lot of greatness. Billy Clement is our guest today on Tell Us Your Story, sponsored by Meridian Bank, one of the area's best business banks. Learn why at meridianbanker.com.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medella is your reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
/WIP.
Yes, this is Kochi, son of Grilled Cheese here. That is right out of a John Wayne Western saga. Duke, what do you think?
Well, I thought the game was yesterday, and here it is Easter today. What do you say?
It's incredible. What are your impressions of this game? Do somebody else. Do a Boom Boom Jeffrey on.
Hey, I want to guarantee you hockey's fan across Canada and the United States that this is one of the greatest hockey game ever in the histories of the National Hockey League. And if you ever heard me, Boomer's Jeffrey on, you know me from the Miller Lite commercial. I'm one of the greatest that ever played the games of hockey in this world. Thank you.
Well, that voice you just heard, imitating John Wayne and Boom Boom Jeffrey on his Bill Clement, a part of the Flyers Stanley Cup teams back in their glory days and a terrific broadcaster for many decades. He joins us today on Tell Us Your Story, sponsored by Meridian Bank, one of the area's best business banks. Learn why at meridianbanker.com/WIP.
Bill, we were talking right before the break there. We were talking about the run to the first cup and meeting the Boston Bruins in the finals, which was a team that the Flyers had never had any success with in the early years of their history, beating them anywhere. I think they had only won one game in their history in Boston Garden, and now you got to play them best of seven for the Stanley Cup with them with home ice advantage. But we had Bobby Clark on earlier in this series to do Tell Us Your Story, and we talked about that series. And Clark, he said, yeah, everybody thought that it was a big upset, and nobody picked us to win. But he said, we as a group, as a team, we felt we were every bit as good as them, if not better. And then he went right down the line. He said, you know, I could play Esposito. And they didn't have anybody that could play McLeish. And he said, and Orr was Orr. Everybody knew that he was the greatest player. He said, but if you went up and down our, and, you know, their goalie was good, but ours was great. He said, if you went man for man beyond Orr, he said, we felt, nobody else felt that way, but we felt that we matched up very well with the Boston Bruins.
Yeah, and that whole mentality was hatched by Clarkie and by Fred Shiro. And I guess if you're an athlete, a young athlete, you don't know any better, and your leaders are saying, you know what, we're as good as they are, and here's why, and go through it, you start drinking the Kool-Aid and going, hell yeah, you know, why not? You brought up a good point. We hadn't won in 7 years in Boston, a total of 31 games,
right.
And we had to win one,
right?
Because we didn't have home ice advantage. So, you know, the game one was tied, and we lost game one with 22 seconds to go, which was incredibly deflating. I was in a cast for some torn ligament in my knee, so I didn't play game one. And I'll never, you know, I've talked to people over the years about stepping out of the playbook and reading from a different script. And that's what Freddie did after game one. Freddie, we had, you know, a meal after game one that we had lost in a heartbreaker. Then Freddie said, okay, everybody listen up. Tomorrow was an off day. He said, I'm going to give you a choice. You can go down to Boston Garden and ride the bus down there. We were staying at a hotel out of town that had a golf course built around it. He said, you can go down and practice for an hour, or you can play nine holes of golf and turn your scorecard into me. And we all kind of looked at each other like Freddie had just grown a second head or a third eye in his head or something. Like, what? Like, was he serious? And I've told this story to people, and I said, so what do you think we voted to do? And most people said, well, you had to go and practice, right? I said, no, we golfed. Like I was in my cast. I golfed and actually took care of my slice. I should have kept the cast on for years after that. So we golfed, and then dramatically in game two, you know, with less than a minute to go, we tied it, and Clarkie won it in overtime, and we had our one game that we won. But Joe Watson tells the best story about getting off the plane and walking through the airport and picking up a newspaper and the headline saying, you know, we've already beat a team better than the Boston Bruins. And it was quoting a member of the Flyers organization. And Joe was, you know, walking along saying, who the hell would say that? Why the hell what the hell's going on? You know, Joe, like, and Freddie Shiro was walking beside him, and Freddie said, I said it. I really thought the Rangers were a better team than the Bruins. He said, I think we just beat a team better than the Boston Bruins, and it made headlines. But Freddie was so brave. You know, he didn't follow the same script that any other coach. Like, don't give them any chance to put anything up on their their wall in the locker room. Freddie was like, well, to hell with that. You know, let's go for it. And it was just a dramatic time and a dramatic series all the way around, including holding our breath in a 1-0 game six victory to clinch. I think Bobby Clark could tell you that he was confident we would win no matter what. But I think most of the guys would say that if we had to go back to Boston for a game seven, we didn't like our chances.
Sure. So you win, and then is what I think a lot of people regard as the greatest, the first in a long time, the best parade in city history. What do you remember about the parade?
Mayhem. I mean, it was so scary. Nobody knew what the parade was going to be like. So they put each guy and his girlfriend or his wife in a car, right? Some convertible, some otherwise. And as we started the parade, I can't tell you where it started even or where it was supposed to end up. Clarkie and Bernie ditched the parade. It was such a massive humanity that we all felt threatened, like we were in a almost like in a riot situation. I remember one of the mounted cops on his horse between they ended up having to get a horse and a cop in between each car so that they could swing their horses back and forth from side to side and literally knock people out of the way so the cars could get through. And it was really scary. I mean, if you were claustrophobic, you had a problem to begin with. But there was, I saw a horse fell on one of the fans and the fan got injured. So it really, I think, took the whole city by surprise. Nobody, including the police force or the Flyers or anybody, had any idea that that first parade was going to be as successful, because if you want to just evaluate success based on the number of people that attended the parade, it was that.
Yeah.
But man, oh man, was it mayhem.
Yeah, the city was, the city's expectation, they told the police to prepare for 100,000 people.
Is that what was told? Really?
Yeah, that was the police were told, prepare as if you're going to be dealing with 100,000 people, and they never expected it to be that. I mean, they thought they were way overstating it at 100,000, but let's say 100,000. Well, Bill, 2 million people came, and you're right, and they were completely overwhelmed. It started down at the Spectrum, and it was supposed to work its way through Center City and end up at Independence Hall. That's where the final point was. But I mean, once you got into the big buildings downtown, you're right, you just couldn't move.
Yeah. I was really relieved when the parade ended. And I don't even know how law enforcement communicated then. It was out of control. It really was. I'm really happy that, you know, nobody was seriously hurt, but that really was the signal of the true love affair between the Broad Street Bullies and the city of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I mean, that should have been that's the big billboard, right? The big neon billboard that flashed love affair flyers and Philadelphia. And it never stopped for years and years and years.
So you win that year, and then they always say repeating is twice as tough, but you guys do. Next year, finals against Buffalo, goes to game 6. By the way, Bill, I was in the seats as a teenage kid watching that game in Buffalo, rooting against you. But you broke my heart, because it's a scoreless game through two periods, Bernie versus Roger Crozier. Bob Kelly scores, I think it's like 11 seconds into the third period. And then with under 3 minutes to go, you score the goal that just puts it away, 2-0 win. Biggest goal of your career. Bill, every kid's dream. You got to live that.
Yeah, and when I look back at it, I'm still kind of surprised at it, in the sense that, first of all, Orris Kinderchuk sacrificed his body and sacrificed, I think, some of his career, because he got killed. They double covered him, Jerry Korab, and I guess it was Bill Hyder, Lee Fogelin along the boards, and they crushed Orris, but they made a bad mistake. They both took him. And I was wide open coming across the blue line, and Orris, as great a passer as he was able to get me the puck. And, you know, I knew I could skate, so I always would do a kind of a mental rehearsal before a game about a breakaway. Like, if I get a breakaway, what am I going to do? Well, Roger Crozier, I knew that he caught with his right hand, and I knew that he really, really crouched low, and I said to myself, okay, remember this, if you get a breakaway, think high glove on Crozier. So Orris got me the puck, and it seemed, when I thought back at I went years without seeing a replay of it. And it seemed like I thought of so many things, and I thought I had quite a bit of time to think about this. The truth is that everything happened in about 1 second. I got the puck. I took it across the pass across my body, and I got it in the shooting position, and I'm thinking high glove. And all I can see is 5-hole. And I knew, I heard Roger Crozier interviewed once, and he said, look, the thing that goalies have to remember is you never make the first move on a shooter, right? Let the person coming in on you on a breakaway make the first move and then react to it. So I thought, okay, so chances are he ain't going to move. So I went in, and I was in the crease, I think, when I chipped it between his pads, and I came close, if not touching one of his pads. I was that close to him, and it seemed so easy that, and it shouldn't have been for me because I wasn't a prolific goal scorer, but it seemed, my thought process, it all worked. It seemed so easy that I was sure that there had to be a whistle that I hadn't heard and that everybody had stopped playing. Mm-hmm. But then Joe Watson tackled me, and I knew it was real because he was screaming in my ear. And I kind of got mobbed on the ice. And when I got to the bench, I was kind of in disbelief. Like, could this have really just happened? And sure enough, it did. And away we went. but that was, then again, that was part of what our team was all about. Here we are in a potential elimination game, which it turned out to be. And who are the guys that score the goals? Bob Kelly and Bill Clement, right?
Yeah.
And we all chipped in when we had to.
I remember interviewing Keith Allen in a couple years after all of that, and he said, you know, what Billy didn't know when he scored that goal was he had, in effect, already been traded. That even while the series was going on, he and Milt Schmidt, the general manager of the Washington Caps, had already discussed and agreed in principle for the trade that was going to send you to Washington when this was all said and done, the deal that was going to send you there for the first pick in the next draft, which turns out to be Mel Bridgman, they had already shaken hands and agreed to the trade before the series was ever over. So you were in effect already on, you know, when you scored the goal that wins the cup for the Flyers, the general manager had already in effect traded you.
Yeah, that wasn't really very nice, was it? I mean, for him to do that. So a couple of interesting things about that. The day of Game 6 in Buffalo, there was an article in the lead Buffalo in Buffalo News that one of either Bill Clement, Dave Schultz, Terry Crist, Bob Kelly, or Don Selesky was going to be traded to the Washington Capitals. And I read it, and I kind of just, you know, said, I've got work to do today. I can't think about that very much. And
it really freaked Schultze out. I mean, he read that article and he said it really bothered him.
Well, I talked to Davey. I felt so bad for Schultze because we got talking on the plane. I mean, it was a love fest, right? When you win the Stanley Cup and we got to be together and skate the cup in Buffalo as we really hadn't been given the opportunity the year before because there were so many fans on the ice in Philadelphia. But I sat down beside Schultze and we were having a beer on the plane. And he said, boy, am I ever glad we won that. He said, I wasn't even close to being in that game. I said, what do you mean? He said, I was so upside down emotionally. I read that I might be traded, that article in the paper that was strategically placed. I mean, the writers then were, you know, everybody got to know them. They were fans of the team as opposed to, you know, guys that were competing with one another to write provocative and evocative stories. So Davey read that. And he was completely undressed by it. And I felt really bad for him because he said, I'm so, so thankful I didn't make a bad mistake in that game because I wasn't in it even a bit from start to finish. It's kind of interesting how things like that help you evaluate your ability to focus through things one way or the other. Right. Mm-hmm. You either have to get better at it or you confirm that you're not too bad at it as it is. I'm just thankful that we won as well. But yeah, I mean, and the draft was less than 2 weeks after that last game. And I was driving back to Canada and stopped at my wife's aunt's place in Syracuse, spent the night there. And she woke me up about 8 in the morning. And she came into the bedroom where I was sleeping and she knocked on the door and opened the door. And she said, Keith Allen's on the phone. He wants to speak to you. And I sat straight up in bed and went out loud, uh-oh.
Yeah.
and that's when Keith very politely said, you're moving on, son.
So we got about 5 minutes to go, and I want to give as much time as we can to your broadcasting career. So you got traded to the Caps of the draft pick, turned out to be Mel Bridgman. You end up going to the Flames. You spent 7 years. Team captain, made 2 All-Star games, great defensive player. And then begins the transition out. You retire in 1981. Eventually, you move into broadcasting. And you are part of a duo here in Philadelphia that many people, myself included, consider one of the best I've ever seen or heard do any team, which is you and Doc Emrick. The chemistry you guys had, I just thought was great. If I can ask you, what was it like to work with Doc? And did you realize you guys were as great as you were?
No, I don't think we realized we were, you know, it's funny. You just work from the inside out and really don't have the opportunity to. I mean, there's no broadcast Olympics where somebody says, hey, these guys win the gold medal.
Yeah.
And we were just focused on excellence. And that's one thing that I so loved about working with Doc. Not only was he generous and kind and sensitive as a partner, but we both wanted to be really good at what we did. And we worked really hard at being really good. I'd have a little training camp at my house for about 3 years in a row. And Coatsy jumped in on it. And we would do all kinds of different television scenarios and different calls and just try to hone our craft. But Doc, it was such a privilege to be able to work with Doc. And by the way, I worked with 36 different play-by-play partners in my career. Some of them only one game. But the guys that I worked with the longest, and I was so fortunate, Doc, and then Gary Thorne, and then Jim Jackson. I mean, this complete professionals. And I tell people, anybody that is willing to listen, I said, you know what they all have in common? The best play-by-play guys, they're really freaking smart. I mean, their IQs are off the chart. I mean, Doc is called Doc because he has a PhD. A lot of people don't know that, you know, in communication.
Yeah,
sure. Yep. So, I was so blessed to be able to work with guys that were, you know, that were really bright and that really cared about their craft and wanted to excel. And those three guys are the three men that I work with the longest, Jim Jackson, Gary Thorne, and Doc Emrick. And I don't know if you could ask for anything more than that as an analyst.
No, they were great teams, all of them. And you were certainly a big part of that. You know, Bill, I remember doing, oh, gosh, must have been 10 years, maybe more, after your career was over, doing a retrospective about the Broad Street Bullies and that era and the back-to-back cups and the teams that you were a part of. And I said to you, you know, there's still very mixed emotions up through the Canadian provinces and through the hierarchy of the National Hockey League about what that Flyer team represented and that era of hockey. And you know, as well as everybody else knows, that you were not a popular champion team. I mean, there was a lot of, right. There were a lot of people didn't like that team, didn't like their style of play. And look back on that and, you know, Ten Dryden's written books about it. That was a dark era for hockey and everything. And you said, you know, the people who feel that way about our team, they can go to hell, was what you said. And I thought, you know, and I thought that was, you know, I understood exactly where that was coming from. Because other people kind of gave political answers about it. But you just said, basically, look, our team, we were really good. We had a lot of really good players, a lot of whom are in the Hall of Fame. And we played our butts off every night and filled every building in the National Hockey League. So anybody that wants to sit on a high horse now and criticize us, they can go to hell. I thought that was really well said.
I haven't changed my opinion one bit, Ray, since then. I'm non-apologetic. I don't think any of our players are. And I really think that all of those people that were Flyers haters, look, you end up living vicariously through your team, whether you're a writer or a fan. And it's almost like being a parent. Like if your kid came home and every day he was had a black eye because the other kid at school was bigger and stronger and tougher than him, you'd end up hating him too. But I really think that, you know, people live vicariously through their connections with their sports teams. And it's one thing for their team to lose. You kind of go home licking your wounds. But when you lose and you also lose the battles and the physical battles and the fights, it's insulting to many people. And I think really that the genesis of a lot of those opinions about it being bad for the sport was simply a product of them, you know, crying because they not only lost, but got beat physically in the process. At least some of it is that. I don't think that anybody ever, and you know what? Nobody in Boston said that we were, you know, antichrists and didn't belong in the NHL. The people in Montreal might have. Well, the Montreal Canadiens, they played hard, and they were bloodied, but they were unbowed most of the time. I still say that, Ray. I think people can go to hell that they didn't evaluate our team for what we had. It was the image that we had that made them say that we didn't belong, that we didn't deserve the cups. We had take a look at the players that we had, Barber and Leach and McLeish and Jimmy Watson and Bernie. Come on, we had a really good team. They just didn't like our style. I'm non-apologetic. I will say that again as loudly as I can.
Bill Clement, you had a lot of opportunities over the last 25 years or so after your career, when you were broadcasting, ESPN, NBC, you did the Olympics, you acted, you were in a soap opera for a while, you were the voice of a NHL video game, which is where my kids remember you from. Any that was a favorite gig over those years?
You know, the only thing that I've ever done that really spoke back to me and said, this is what you were meant to do, was not hockey. And it was not broadcasting. It was acting. Hmm. And we were living in New York. My wife, I had divorced my first wife, and my wife Sissy and I had met on an audition. We were paired up to read as husband and wife, and we did really well in Atlanta. Asked agents if we were good enough to compete in New York. They said, sure, yeah, you are. So we went to New York. We still weren't married, but the phone rang one day, and it was ESPN asking me if I wanted to audition for one of their jobs as color analyst. And I can tell you guys that auditioning for your lunch and your rent as an actor every week, it's hard. So the idea of a regular paycheck kind of appealed to me, and I said, sure, I'll audition for one of the spots as color analyst. Brad Park had left the booth and gone to coach the Detroit Red Wings. So I said, what does the audition consist of? And they said, a live game on the air. And I swallowed real hard, and I said, okay, and went to Chicago Stadium and did a game, Minnesota North Stars in Chicago, and ended up getting the job and never looked back and did very well broadcasting. But the one thing that seemed to speak to me was acting, and I loved it, but I had to make the choice. My broadcasting career grew. As it grew, the emphasis on an acting career, that's why my name is pronounced Clement now. I was Bill Clement my whole life. But when I got to ESPN, I said, can we pronounce my name Clement on the air? I don't want to be recognized as a sportscaster when I go into a serious acting audition. And they said, yeah, sure. So I'm the only one in my family stuck with a mispronunciation of my name.
Bill, we gotta wrap this up. One last question. I want to ask you what you're kind of doing in retirement. But before that, last time we spoke to you, which was shortly after hockey came back from the pandemic, you were out as a broadcaster at NBC Sports Philadelphia, and you know, you said you were ready for retirement, but there was a sense that they kind of had left you hanging there. Is that true, and how do you feel about that looking backwards?
I think it was I think I was ready to retire, but I would have to wait and wait and wait and wait to see what my role would be, to see if there was a contract offer coming my way. And in that sense, I felt disrespected, that I deserved more communication than that. So it was time. I wish it had happened differently, because I did not feel that I was respected as I was preparing for my retirement. And I move on. I don't hold grudges, and I don't look back. My nature is to always look forward. And the rearview mirror is something that is for other people, I guess. I'm too busy figuring out what I'm going to do next. So there was a somewhat of a bad taste in my mouth, but you know, a little bit of mouthwash and a martini, and everything's okay moving forward.
I would separate those two by an hour or so, but I get you. Listen, it was a pleasure watching you as a player in this town. It was definitely a pleasure having you as a broadcaster, and it's been a pleasure for us this hour. Bill Clement is our guest on Tell Us Your Story, sponsored by Meridian Bank, one of the area's best business banks. Learn why at meridianbanker.com/WIP. Bill, all the best to you, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.